Hi. I'm here to tell you a bit of a story today, and the first part of it will be sort of review. I've been told by Dr. Z that I need to definitely review things for the physicists in the audience and translate astrospeak into physics, which I will try to do. And the second part of the talk will be sort of an advertisement and a little bit of a description of work in progress on my favorite project at the moment, which is the 2-micron all-sky survey. By definition, in astronomy these days, especially for large observational projects, there are large numbers of people that are involved. Just to mention some of the key players early on in the game, my major collaborators have been Mark Aronson, no longer with us, Mark Davis, Margaret Geller, Jeremy Mould, Mike Strauss, so on and so forth. There's the 2-micron all-sky survey galaxy team, and I'll tell you who those folks are when we get to that part of the talk, but they are really the key players here, and I'm really just the front man, so I will tell you the story from that point of view. The object of the game that we're talking about is essentially trying to understand our place in the universe and the distribution of things. It's probably better to show the plot that way, but I've labeled it that way because that's how it came out of the book. To try to understand the distribution of matter, galaxies in the first part, matter in the large part around us, understand how that distribution impacts on our understanding of cosmology as a whole, and all the other bits and pieces that go along with that. The story, of course, is a very long one, and I won't take you back to t equals zero, because that would take, I'd spend all my time doing nothing but history, and I'm not a history professor. But the story in this century, because extragalactic astronomy, as we know it, is really a very modern science that does only date back to about 1920, 1925 or so. You know, understand in 1925, the great debate about whether galaxies were external objects the size of the Milky Way or just pieces of fluff that were part of the Milky Way. Was the universe the galaxy or was the universe something bigger? Wasn't really decided absolutely until the end of the 1920s, 1924, when Hubble made his observation of variable stars in the Andromeda galaxy. So the real subject didn't start all that long ago. Anyway, one of the very first attempts to try to map the distribution of galaxies in space was made at my own institution, Harvard, by Shapley, Harlow Shapley and Adelaide Ames in the 1930s. They essentially took photographic plates using very small cameras. And they're 6-inch diameter lenses, basically, put in front of 8 by 10 inch glass photographic plates and counted galaxies that they could see on these plates. They had an observing station in Peru, one up north in Harvard, Massachusetts. They counted about 1,300 galaxies, and they made this map of the sky. It had some interesting properties, not the least of which was that there's a big empty region where that line is, called the zone of avoidance, a.k.a. where our own galaxy, the Milky Way, gets in the way and causes us not to really be able to see things very well. That's a major player in this story, and we'll come back to that. And the other thing that they saw was that over the rest of the sky, galaxies were not uniformly distributed. In fact, nearby galaxies tended to lie pretty much on a line on the sky with a large clump in the center. We now call this clump and this line the local supercluster of galaxies. Lots of semantic terms that get stuck with that one because it's not entirely what astronomers nowadays would call a supercluster, but nonetheless, this is the local supercluster. But all we know about it back in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s was the distribution of about 1,300 galaxies on the sky. Major advances were made, unfortunately, only by counting more galaxies for a long period of time. One of the important counters was this character. Some of you may know him, may know of him, Fritz Zwicky. But I show this for two reasons. Fritz was one of the people who did devote most of his life, in fact, to making catalogs of galaxies and or other things, astronomical life. He did a lot of other things as well. Fritz was a famous mountain climber. You know, he has a bunch of he liked to do a lot of that, a bunch of first ascents up in Alaska. But sitting underneath him here is a 6-volume set of a catalog of galaxies and clusters of galaxies that does feature prominently later on in the story as well. Anyway, the best that those guys could do through, in fact, the early part of the 1970s was make better and better maps of the sky, and they did. Zwicky's catalog contains not 1,300 galaxies, but about 30,000, 31,964 or whatever. There were catalogs made not of galaxies, but of counts of galaxies at Lick, which contained millions of galaxies, but they didn't have individual objects noted, so they're a little harder to work with. But it was still a case that up through the middle of the 1970s or so, the only information that astronomers, physicists, astrophysicists really had about the distribution of stuff in space around us, outside the Milky Way, were these maps of things on the sky. There's no real systematic attempt to do anything much deeper than that. And the reason for that is that distances are very hard. Real distances to galaxies are incredibly hard. And in fact, another one of my sidelines is measuring distances to galaxies with Hubble Space Telescope and or other things. And just to show you how bad it is, this is about, well, actually at the moment you're looking at very close to all of the list of galaxies to which independent distances have been measured with any reasonable degree of accuracy, aka distances measured using Cepheid variable stars or something like that. Even today, Hubble Space Telescope having been up and working well for five plus years, all the work that's been done on the ground, large telescopes, adaptive optics, or whatever, there are less than 50 galaxies with real independent distance measurements to them. Right? Accurate, right? Where accurate is defined as sort of the 10% level. Right? That is all she wrote. So the object of the game in the middle of the 1970s was to try to use a trick that was actually, a trick is not quite the right word, but it's a good one. It was actually discovered by this character, Edwin Hubble. It is one of the four laws for which Hubble is famous. Hubble discovered a lot. He was really the observational giant of the early 20th century in astronomy. Alan Sandage is the observational giant of the late 20th century. But Hubble's most famous law is this one. This is his, not his absolute original data, but the review paper he wrote in 1936, plotting velocity versus distance. The velocity is the apparent recessional velocity. I get it, don't worry. Apparent recessional velocity of galaxies as a function of their distance. Hubble, of course, didn't quite get it right. He was off by a factor of somewhere between 8 and 10. But nonetheless, it did provide us a technique that allowed us to at least measure relative distances to large number of galaxies relatively quickly. Excuse me? That's a whole nother colloquium. And I'll talk to you next week. All right. Okay. Excuse me? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Rather considerably. Now, velocities actually happen. I mean, basically, even back in the 1920s, people were able to measure, 1912, people were able to measure velocities, apparent redshifts of objects, extremely accurately, right? But the distances have changed by a huge amount over the years. And in part, it's because Hubble made a lot of mistakes. But that's okay. When you're first, you can afford to make mistakes. Right? That's right. And in fact, it is incredibly linear. And just by way of advertisement for another project, which is just about finished up, which has finished up, where the last analysis papers for this, but one, the one I should be writing now, are now in press. Actually, there are two. Wendy Friedman has to write one as well. Are now in press in the Astrophysical Journal. The H-naught key project, which is a set of people, among others, that measured a large number of those distances, independent distances to galaxies, and almost everybody else who are playing in the game, are now agreed that the Hubble constant is somewhere between, the number I wrote down on the previous view graph is probably a fairer estimate of the full range. We're talking about somewhere between 55 and 80 kilometers per second per megaparsec. And I would say that at the moment, from the key project data, if you put in all the corrections for all of the things that astronomers need to correct for, like chemistry is important in the Hubble constant, you end up with a value which is 68 plus or minus 7, or thereabouts. So we almost but not quite made our goal of knocking the uncertain. This is true external uncertainty, which is a big improvement in the game. We almost, but not quite, made our goal of getting down to below 10% on the error in H-naught. Because the stars you see here, and you calibrate nearby, or calibrate in the Magellanic Clouds, have different average chemical abundances than the stars that you see in other galaxies. And those abundances change the atmosphere. This is the short, the one-line answer, right? Is that the change in the chemical composition of the atmospheres of the stars is sufficient to change the way they pulsate, to change the correlation between luminosity and period. So you have to correct for that. And if you don't, you get into trouble. You get into trouble at the 10-20% level, not at the factor of 5 level, but you do get into trouble. So chemistry is important. Excuse me? The LMC distance in there is 18.5. And again, if you want to hear about that, that's a whole other colloquium, which I'd be more than glad to give some talk. But if we get into that game, we'll be here forever. At least today, that's not the topic of the talk. Okay. I don't think that's right, by the way, but it's not so far wrong. The way that one goes about using Hubble's relation, and then, as I said, for the purpose of making a lot of these maps, one doesn't have to have absolute distances. One just wants to know that the relation is linear. And I could show you a plot, but I don't have it here with me, that does indeed show that the relation between apparent recessional velocity and distance is incredibly linear over the range of nearby space, and before we begin to see the cosmological effects. So the way, in fact, we go about and started going about making maps of the distribution of galaxies in the 1970s, in the middle of the 1970s, was by getting large numbers of redshifts for galaxies. Now, why 1970s? Why not 1960s? Why not 1950s? Well, in 1970 and 1975 or so, a number of things happened that were technological things happened that were extremely important for astronomy. One was that we started using electronic detectors on the back ends of telescopes, and not photographic plates or not the old eyeball. Okay, usually photographic plates were the classical things. The other was, at about the same time, radio astronomy and radio spectroscopy, a very sensitive 21-centimeter spectroscopy of galaxies became possible because the receivers became low enough noise. So it was an improvement in electronic detectors. You started having detectors with quantum efficiencies that were 50, 60, 70% as opposed to 2% or 0.5% like a photographic plate. And you also started having radio receivers with low enough system temperatures and noises so that you could make accurate measurements of large numbers of galaxies quickly. Part of the game is quickly. A thing I like to tell especially kids when I go and talk about making maps of the universe to high schools and whatever, is that the revolution in detectors that took place in the 1970s, and in fact still is taking place in the infrared today, right, allowed us to use a 1.5-meter telescope to get a redshift for a galaxy in about 10 minutes that took Milton Humason 4 days on the 100-inch telescope back 50 years. Right? It's that kind of qualitative difference that has happened. And there's another big change coming. And the way that that's done is very simple. You get a spectrum of an object. There are lots of features. Here's the chemistry again. Calcium, H and K, cyanogen lines, whatever. You see where these lines are shifted to relative to where those features would appear in a laboratory on the surface of the Earth. And that's how you measure the redshift. The other ingredient in the game, of course, is this one. Gary Larson almost got it right, and that is that the key factor here is that he didn't say all night. He said all day long a tough gang of astrophysicists would monopolize the telescope. In reality, at least in the optical. In the radio, you could do it in the day, but in the optical. Yeah, even identifies people, okay. I'm short, fat, and balding with a beard, right. So, right. And anyway, we can get into the people later, too, but that's a different story. Excuse me? we wanted to protect the innocent as long as we could, but the guilty was fair game. Anyway, not to belabor the story too much, but suffice it to say that of the order of 10, 12 years worth of work, and now closer to 20 years since I at least started this game, started playing in this game in the mid-1970s has come to fruition. One of the key results you've probably seen before was the first strip of the sky that Valerie Delaperrant, Margaret Geller, and I completed in 1985, June of 1985. The paper came out in early 1986. And basically, what you're looking at here, and I'll show you a few more of these throughout the talk, so you'll have some idea of what's, might as well spend, digress a little bit and spend a little bit of time here. We are at the origin, okay, looking outwards. There's a strip on the sky of galaxies that whose redshifts have been measured. The strip, in fact, corresponds to a strip straight out of Old Zwicky's catalog. One of those six blue volumes are arranged in declination bands around the sky, lines of latitude, essentially, 6 degrees wide. This was the first of the ones that we did. It was 6 degrees wide. We measured redshifts for every galaxy in the strip. Part of the story, some of you might have heard this, but part of the story that makes it interesting was that, in fact, there was a bit of a debate that was going on before we started actually doing the survey about what technique ought to be used. And Margaret was a key proponent of doing strips. Mark Davis wanted to do something a little bit different. I had been working with Mark at the time. Simon had a few ideas about what to do. And I think I attribute things to Simon, which are probably not what his ideas were. But suffice it to say that Simon was a player in trying to discuss how to go about doing these redshift surveys. And while all of these debates were going on, amongst the primarily theoretical people in the game, Mark is a theorist in my eyes, right? I was trying to figure out what was the most effective way of using the telescope, right? And we ended up doing strip surveys because, in effect, if you're getting redshifts sort of one at a time, which is what the technology was in those days, if you do a strip around the sky, you can observe incredibly efficiently. Because you just sit there, and as the Earth rotates and the sky goes past, you just move the telescope little bits and wiggle it around, basically, to catch the galaxies as they go by in strips of what are called right ascension, the equivalent of longitude. So this is a plot of a wedge on the sky. It's about 6 degrees thick. We're looking down on the top of it. This is redshift off in this dimension. Okay, redshift is essentially relative distance. 15,000 kilometers a second, if you believe the current value of the Hubble constant, would be about 200 megaparsecs, 200 million parsecs, or about 600 million light years, give or take a little change, okay, or about 5% of the distance to the horizon in the universe. Okay, this is, roughly speaking, it's 8 hours to 17 hours of right ascension, so it's a little bit more than a third of the way around the sky, okay? And as I said, 6 degrees thick. So it's a slice of the universe is what people called it. We were pretty surprised by the results. I mean, I didn't expect this at all because the prevailing view at the time was that galaxies were distributed sort of like matzo balls in a soup. There were lumps that were clusters of galaxies, and then there was a uniform field. In fact, field galaxy is a term which is still used quite a lot in the game. And nowadays, we know there isn't really a field in such terms. And what was very surprising about this was essentially the fact that you had large voids and empty regions. Voids had been discovered before. Kirshner, Omler, Schechter, Shachtman, back 5 years before this, published the first paper on finding a very large void. But everybody thought it was a fluke, a one-of. Yeah, there's this empty region in space, so what else is new? Okay. And what we were able to show, what Margaret and I and students and company showed, is in fact that voids occupy 90%. 90% of the universe is, by and large, low density relative to the mean density of galaxies. About 1,100. Right. By definition, we've kept working on this. This is a modern-day version of the plot that showed the Great Wall, essentially more slices in the same region of space, except now, instead of being 6 degrees thick, this is 30 degrees thick, so there are 5 slices. This one happens to go out to 20,000 kilometers a second, making it to show against something else. Here you can see the local supercluster. It's a finger of God. I used to call them fingers of God after Jay Richard, who first explained the effect to me, but it's fingers of God. They always point right at the observer. That's where in a cluster of galaxies the velocity dispersion has caused things to be spread out in redshift space along the line of sight. You see a bunch of them. This is the Hercules cluster over there. The Coma cluster is in here, Abel 1367, and a variety of other things. The aficionados in the audience can recognize them immediately. And the Great Wall is this large structure that pretty much goes all the way across. Now, in fact, we know this plot goes from 6 hours instead of 8 hours. Now, in fact, we know that it doesn't just go straight across. It sort of ends in another bubble over here, okay? And it's not entirely a constant redshift. It curves around, goes from about 10,000 kilometers a second here to about 6,000 kilometers a second there. It's a structure which I think still holds the record, maybe not, given some of the redshift 3 stuff, but still holds the record for the largest structure that anybody has found in the universe in terms of size. It won't for much longer. There are huge surveys coming. And just to show you what that looks like on the sky, here we have color-coded the redshifts just in a very narrow band of radial velocity, namely the same band that contains that structure, right? About 90 to 125 million parsecs, right? In light years, 280 to 380 million light years, so on and so forth. 3 codes. And the wall itself, in fact, is a bit Swiss cheesy. It's got structures in it as well. Okay, a little bit more blue and green at one end, a little bit more red at the other. Okay, the story keeps going. There are a lot of redshift surveys that are around. This is what the CFA looks like around the whole sky now. Full sky map, you are here looking out. You can see the Great Wall in the top. You can see, here, here's a pointer. You can see another large structure, the Pisces-Perseus chain, which has been pretty extensively studied by Giovanelli and Haynes. You can see some background stuff over here. All right, here's our friend, the local supercluster. You can also see, and this is everything with a redshift, not magnitude limited, not uniformly sampled. You can also see these pretty large empty regions, which are not empty. They're, in fact, where the Milky Way gets in the way and causes us to get into trouble. This is 15,000 kilometers a second. So again, it's about 5% of the horizon radius, right? Cubit, and that tells you, roughly speaking, cubit and one-half it, cubit and about one-third it, and that will tell you, roughly speaking, how much of a volume of space we have a reasonable map of. And nowadays, I keep a master catalog of all redshifts that have been measured. The number as of February 1st, it's 136,000, roughly speaking, galaxies with measured redshifts. The CFA survey that Margaret and I and Valerie started back in 1985 is complete. The data paper's out. You can get it from the web. We didn't publish all of the data. Page charges in the AppJ would be kind of prohibitive. But there are electronic versions that are now available. And that has 15,900 galaxies. It's sort of state-of-the-art today, and it won't be state-of-the-art tomorrow. There are other big redshift surveys come along that are going to very easily clean its clock. But right now, it's one of the better ones that are around. Despite all of that work, despite the fact that we have 130,000 redshifts, we still have some problems in understanding the galaxy distribution. And here's, again, an example of that. This is a plot on the sky, just nearby galaxies, 3,000 kilometers a second. I like to show this because it has so much information in it. It makes me feel like I'm a true scion of one of my old advisors, Eco Eben, who is famous for showing very difficult diagrams. Everything in one of these symbols has a reason. The type of symbol tells you what kind of galaxy it is. The size tells you how bright it is. And the color tells you what the redshift is. But here's another plot. My version of Shapley and Ames's plot of the local supercluster, now limited in redshift space, so we actually know, roughly speaking, the relative distances of galaxies. This is the local supercluster through here, Virgo cluster in here, and this is the other side of the sky. We still have this giant region, the zone of avoidance, which has not been well probed, and rather unfortunately, that happens to be a pretty important chunk of space. All right, and I'll tell you why. Okay. The reason is, now, when you actually think not about just the prettiness of redshift surveys, which sometimes people do, there are lots of physical reasons, astrophysical reasons, for trying to do redshift surveys and study something with them. And just to list a few, this is not everything that one gets into. The primary goals of redshift surveys are to study the statistics of large-scale structure, and that was one of the things that the CFA surveys, the first one that Mark Davis and I did, and the second one with Margaret, was aimed at doing. And there are now big surveys coming along, as I said, that will very soon clean our clocks. The 2DF survey now has about probably, if I have to make a guess, the last time I saw the numbers was 52,000 redshifts. As soon it'll be about 60,000. And the Sloan survey, the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is just now starting up their spectroscopic observations, aims at getting about 1 million galaxy redshifts, right, over the next 5 to 7 years, or however long it's going to take. Julianne's in the audience. She can probably tell you a little bit more about the spectroscopy for that. So that's one game. And in fact, at some level, these surveys are actually just attempting to put the icing on the cake, really nail down the fine structure statistics. David Spergel's in the audience as well. He can tell you a lot about Sloan. Nail down the fine points of the statistics of large-scale structure and galaxy biasing. Another part of the game is to map the local density field, right, to try to understand where galaxies are, and in particular, whether or not there's a match between the density field and the velocity field. And this is one of the places where we do run into lots of trouble. There are very few all-sky surveys of galaxy redshifts. Right? There are, at the moment, sort of two. One called the ORS, the Optical Redshift Survey, that I worked on with Mike Strauss, Basilio Santiago, Carl Fisher, a few other people, basically attempted to use optical galaxy IDs and suffers tremendously from this problem with the zone of avoidance. It has about 8,000 galaxies total in it. It misses the galactic plane. It is about the best that one can do in the optical. Then there's a whole set of IRAS-based surveys using the 60-micron survey of the sky that was done by the IRAS satellite in 1982, all right, starting out with the 1.936 Jansky survey, then QDOT, then the 1.2 Jansky survey, then the, what's called the PSCZ survey, which has just come out. Okay, again, data now available on the web, and an advertisement for that. That's a very nice data set. But the problems with the IRAS surveys is that they, too, are very sparse. Even the PSCZ survey only has about 16,000 redshifts, a little less than that in terms of their uniform sample. It goes out much deeper than the CFA survey. Most distant objects in this catalog are out at sort of 30,000 kilometers a second as opposed to sort of 15,000 kilometers a second. But think of a survey that has the same number of galaxies as the CFA survey and covers about 20 times the volume of the CFA survey, and you can see you get into lots of troubles when you start talking about the details of the density field. So the game that I've been very interested in trying to do something with is understand this correlation between the galaxy density field and the velocity field. So it's what I would call the omega, well, what is called, not by me alone, the omega problem. How much dark matter is there in the universe? Where is it? Is the dark matter correlated with the galaxy distribution? Can we measure the dark matter distribution by looking at the velocity fields of galaxies, i.e. independent measures of distance and velocity that allow you to tell how the galaxies are moving with respect to the expansion of the universe, so on and so forth. There are subcontexts of the problem. One is the fact that, now more than 20 years ago, but certainly nailed by Kobe of order 8 or 9 years ago, we know that the Milky Way is moving, the local group is moving, with a velocity of about 600 kilometers a second with respect to the microwave background, the cosmic microwave background. That shows up as a dipole in the temperature on the sky. It's an incredibly good dipole. In fact, it's so incredibly good that it's probably the most precise velocity measurement of anything that I know of extragalactic, cosmological. We know that to now something on the order of 630.3 plus or minus 7 kilometers a second, which is incredible. Okay, it was discovered, this motion with respect to the microwave background was discovered in the late 1970s, and in fact, part of the game has been to try to understand where it comes from. We also know from about that time that we're falling into the local supercluster. that thing that I showed you on the sky, and we get back to the reason for showing you that plot, right, has mass. It's an overdensity. It's an overdensity of somewhere between a factor of 2 and 4, depending on how you want to do the counting. In fact, the uncertainty in that is an important thing that I'd like to understand better. And we know from surveys of the velocity field, this attempt to try to measure distances and velocities at the same time, that, in fact, the local group is falling into the Virgo cluster, the core of the local supercluster, with some velocity that's probably of the order of 200 or so kilometers a second. This is at a velocity of about 1,000. So our motion with respect to the galaxy and the local group, motion with respect to the expansion of the universe has been slowed down by 20%, right, due to the gravitational field of the local supercluster of that order. We also know that on even larger scales, there are larger lumps, one of which is called a great attractor. There are a few others that are around. And again, since this is a physics colloquium, I won't go into the gory details of all the possibilities. The great attractor was discovered in 1986 by a group of folks called the Seven Samurai. And I challenge the astronomers in the room to tell me who corresponds to all of the initials. BDDFLTW. You got one. You know that one, right? Right. I'm not part of this group, right? Okay. Burstein, Davis, Dressler, Faber, Lindenbell, Terlevich, and Wegener. Right? Okay. And followed up by observations by a fairly large number of people attempting to disprove it or prove it, as the case may be. Han and Mold being amongst them, me being amongst them. I being one of the early non-believers in the Great Attractor, now being very converted to the existence of the Great Attractor, or something like it. May not be exactly what those guys said, but there's something sure happening there. And now through today, this is sort of the best of the existing catalogs of peculiar velocities of galaxies, something called the Mark III catalog, produced by many of the same people and their students from the Seven Samurai collaborations. Okay, this contains about 1,300 galaxies with not very good, but still good enough, distance estimates to galaxies. These are not precise. They're 20% distances to individual galaxies. But if you get enough of them, you can use that to try to map the cosmic velocity field. And these guys do that. And the object of the game, of course, is to try to make that match between the velocity field and the density field from either IRS or ORS or whatever else you can find, and test the paradigm that light traces mass, test the paradigms that we understand the cause of our dipole motion with respect to the microwave background. And frankly, at the moment, we don't. We're close. We can sort of get 5/6 of the way there, but you know, where's the remaining 10 or 20% of our motion? We don't have the direction right from at least the local universe. It's close, but as they would say in trade, it's not quite good enough for government work. And basically, to try to understand where the dark matter is in space. The IRAS surveys are wonderful. Here's the second densest one, the 1.2 Jansky survey, in the sense that they are uniform around the sky. But this is essentially the same map that I showed you for the CFA survey in the north. Instead of about 18,000 galaxies in our survey, in the north up to 60 degrees, deck 0 to plus 60, IRAS 1.2 Jansky has 2,900 galaxies, and the PSCZ goes up on that by about a factor of 1.6 or so, 1.7. Okay. So the IRAS surveys are not particularly dense. They do a reasonably good job of penetrating into the plane. One of the problems is that, in fact, in these peculiar velocity maps, you can't even see the local supercluster. The very first thing that we dynamically found in the nearby universe that affected the velocity, the Virgo cluster is about here. And the smoothing that's been required in this peculiar velocity map to show even this smooths things out on scales that are essentially the scale of our distance between the distance between the local group and the core of the local supercluster. So you don't see the local supercluster motion. Right? So what can one do about it? Right? How does one try to improve on the situation? The answer is to try to do something that allows you to get, number one, a much larger sample of galaxies, right? Here is the cartoon that I was going to show at this point, right? The dark matter sandwich. No one knows what's in it. I can't tell you what's in the dark matter sandwich. No one knows what's in the dark matter sandwich. Number one, a large enough sample of galaxies so that you can actually look in detail at the density field nearby and even far enough out so that you stand a chance of seeing convergence to the microwave background dipole, right? Number two, it has to be dense, right? Large and dense means more or less the same kind of thing. So the depth has to be big. The density of galaxies has to be large enough. And number three, you want to be able to sample at low galactic latitudes. Because it turns out, rather perversely, nature sometimes does do bad things to astronomers. The direction, the maximum direction of our motion with respect to the microwave background, lies in the zone of avoidance. So if we want to try to understand what is pulling us off there at 630 kilometers a second, we have to make a good survey of the galactic plane, of the galaxy distribution behind our own galaxy. So in the late 1980s, a bunch of us had some interesting ideas in this game. It actually started, the 2-micron all-sky survey actually started in 1988. A fellow by the name of Giovanni Fazio, who most of you might not know, but some might. He's a very famous infrared astronomer who likes to build things. He's, in fact, building the short wavelengths, where short is up to about 12 microns, up to about 8 micron cameras on the CERTIF satellite, which is hopefully going to fly in the next couple of years, decided he wanted to try to test the detectors that they were developing for CERTIF. And one opportunity to do that was to fly a small satellite, a small explorer, a SMEX. France is in the audience, and she can tell you lots of things about SMEXes. But basically, the idea that Giovanni had was that he had these detectors. They'd never been flown in space before. What the heck? Let's try to put a couple of them up. They're very sensitive. They'd be very interesting. So he came to talk to a few people, me, luckily, being one of them, and said, you know, we want to do this. We want to test the detectors. We think we can reach these sort of magnitude limits. Can you think of good scientific projects that could be done with a satellite like this? And I started thinking about what could be done and realized that in fact, 6 months of a satellite, small satellite, would allow us to really produce an exquisite map, not only of the stellar distribution in the Milky Way. You'd find every giant star, every red giant in the Milky Way, no matter where it was, would show up in this survey. But it will also produce a really good uniform survey of the galaxy distribution, because you can do exquisite photometry in space. That's one of the reasons you go up there. So we submitted a proposal. Giovanni was the PI. There were a whole bunch of other people. Jeremy Mould was on it. His interest is the same as mine, the galaxy distribution, but also looking at the stellar distribution in the Milky Way to study Milky Way dynamics, basically, the structure of our own galaxy, never mind the structure of the universe. A whole bunch of other people. We submitted a proposal in 1988. It was called NIRAS, the Near Infrared All-Sky Survey, and it was turned down. Right? The review committee said, hey guys, you know, it's 2 microns only that you're working at. You can do it from the ground. It's cheaper to do it from the ground. Big mistake. But nonetheless, they said, it's great science. Somebody ought to do it. Why don't you do it from the ground? So Susan Kleinman, who was on the review committee, by the way, who was a good friend of mine, still is. that requires a beer for the telling. Came to CFA as a visiting professor for a year, and she and I started working on the original proposal for 2MASS. To essentially do it from the ground to NASA. Eventually, the sources of funding for this included NASA, the University of Massachusetts, the Air Force, the U.S. Naval Observatory, the Smithsonian, the National Science Foundation, and NASA through IPAC, the Infrared Image Processing and Analysis Center in Pasadena, which will be the science center for CERTIF. Right? We submitted the proposal at the end of 91. We started getting trickles of interest, but the first real funding came in 1993 when NASA gave us a bunch of money to start working on the cameras, and the National Science Foundation gave us a bunch of money to work on the cameras and build the telescopes. Mike Skrutsky became the PI in 1994. There's a story there which I will not tell, right? But Mike is an excellent instrumentalist, and in fact has been one of the major reasons that the cameras have worked as well as they have. Right? Susan was the heart, Mike was the hands, I suppose I was the sole in the, as in bottom of the foot. Right? We saw first light with the first telescope at the Whipple Observatory in 1997, first light at Cerro Tololo in 1998, and if we're really lucky, we're going to finish at the end of this year, lucky with the weather. And if we're not really lucky, it might take us a few more months, but things are going extremely well. And the best way I can describe this for those of you who know something about the game of collecting data is that at the moment, the science team for TUMAS is drinking from a fire hose, and we are madly trying to meet our commitments to NASA to try to get the data in the public hands as soon as possible. We have another big data release that should have been out a couple of months ago, but we think we're going to make it in February. Now, this is the first telescope going in at Mount Hopkins in February of 1997. They're small telescopes, 1.3 meters. They use a rather interesting survey strategy that was designed by Frank Lowe called freeze frame scanning. These detectors are not CCDs, so they cannot be drift scanned. So what essentially happens is that the telescope is scanned in a great circle. You've got to scan in a great circle to avoid the problem of essentially the rotation of the image due to, you know, the fact that cosines change from one side of the scan to the other. Okay, so you scan in great circles, and at the same time that you're scanning the telescope smoothly, you ratchet the secondary back. So the secondary of the telescope is tracking, and any point on the sky is imaged for 1 second six times. So there's a six pattern overlap. Not only that, the secondary has enough active control that we actually dither the image. So even though we start out with two arc second pixels on the sky, the dithering and the six times sampling allows us to get about 1.4 arc second resolution with these small 256K detectors. This is the Mount Hopkins telescope at night working. In fact, if you didn't have this funny shading due to the image pattern, you'd actually be able to tell that it was a photometric night, and we've been pretty lucky that way. No, it's equatorial. Turns out that for small telescopes, if you want to scan along great circles, in this case the great circles are circles of declination, okay, you're better off with an equatorial map. So that's what it is. There was wire that died, and that was a small but not all sky survey. And Ned is in fact working on an infrared survey, but it's not 2 microns. His is longer wavelength. Right? And the answer is yes, but no. It's also lower physical resolution on the sky. So there's a small problem. If you really want to pick out galaxies from stars as opposed to just sources, you want to play this game. The 2 micron all sky survey is interesting for a variety of reasons. This is just some of the requirements that are on the survey. And being good proposers, we very carefully promised much less than we think we actually can deliver. So that's to say, we wanted to make sure we met our specs. We are essentially measuring galaxies with 10% accuracy to K magnitudes of 13.5. I'll tell you a little bit about what that means in a bit, but we don't have too much time. And you're a physics audience, not an astronomy audience. We want to be essentially complete, the differential completeness greater than 90% for extended sources. In fact, we're going to be greater than 90% down to 10 degrees of galactic latitude. We'll probably do better than that. The differential reliability, again, for extended sources, we're going to be up at the level of about 90%, even down to 10 degrees of galactic latitude. Unfortunately, 10% is a large error rate, and it does mean a lot of work for people like me, but I suppose that's job security. The reason it's a lot of work is that this survey of the sky is going to essentially find something on the order of, we're going to have about 3 million galaxies complete, about 1 million galaxies complete to K of 13.5, and 3 million galaxies total in the catalog. We're going to have about 100 million to 300 million stars in the catalog, so 300 million objects. And we've been going through this problem. If you're really, unfortunately for galaxies, it's really nasty. For stars, it's not quite so bad. If you want to actually categorize the objects by all of the image parameters, plus the photometry, plus all the other bits and pieces that are necessary to do that, for an individual star, you need sort of 50 bytes of data. And if you have 300 million of them, that's a lot of storage. You're not going to have the catalog sitting on your desk this year, although the way storage is going, it'll come along pretty quickly. The other reason that 2Mass is very interesting, and I've sort of hinted it, but I haven't told you exactly the driver for it, is that at 2 microns, the dust extinction in the Milky Way is down by about a factor it ends up being about a factor of 14 or 15 from the dust extinction in the blue, which is where the optical surveys were done. Right? So you have a penetrating power that's better than a factor of 10, better than the optical surveys, just by going to 2 microns. The other thing, and I will show you this a little bit later on, is that galaxies, the luminosity of galaxies, peaks at about 1.6 microns. So the most light from galaxies is actually coming out in the near-infrared. The peak of the spectral energy distribution is in the near-infrared. And it happens to be coming from a very, very uniform stellar population at that point. So in many ways, and for every reason that I can think of at least, doing surveys for galaxies at 2 microns is a real winner. And here's an example of one of those. Again, the astronomers in the audience will appreciate this. This is a beautiful barred spiral galaxy that is at the very edge of the local group. It's MOFFI 2. Okay. If you tried to find this on the Palomar Sky Survey, even the new one, all right, you'd see a blotch right there, and you wouldn't see any of the spiral structure. It's basically impossible to see. But at 2 microns, 6-second integrations, it's duck soup on the ground. Okay. And remember, this is 6-second integrations at any point on the sky. Same thing. Here's another one of the art shots from the survey, the Sombrero Galaxy. In the optical, there's a huge dust lane that swaths across the galaxy. You can see it here in this image, even at 2 microns. Remember, the extinction to the galactic center is about 30 magnitudes in the optical, right? Which makes it about 2 or 3 magnitudes in the infrared. But we're finding galaxies and doing pretty good with them. Just more examples. This is the kind of analysis that's done on the images. For the extended sources, I won't tell you about the stars, because the subject of the game here is large-scale structure. We essentially identify galaxies as extended sources by doing point spread fitting on the objects. We remove superposed stars to get accurate, like this guy. You see a little red circle around him. To get accurate measurements of the brightnesses of the galaxies. We measure the brightnesses of the galaxies in fiducial apertures, but we also produce what's called isophotal photometry, 19th magnitude per square arc second and 20th magnitude per square arc second at K. At H and J, they're slightly different numbers. It was to produce a very uniform set of data. Okay, these are the Palomar Sky Survey images of the same galaxies. And in fact, at high galactic latitude, you wouldn't expect much difference between the two. The properties of the galaxies that we find are incredibly uniform. Just to give you an idea of what the magnitude limit of the survey is, you can usually do that just by looking at number counts as a function of magnitude. The number of galaxies in the data release up through this past fall, so this set has about, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. This has about 1.3 million galaxies in it. Okay, and you can see the number counts rising more or less as they ought to in Euclidean sense. I just did it on a log-log plot. You'd see it a little bit better. This is log on the bottom. And then falling off at about 14th magnitude. So this is the K-band, the 2 micron magnitude. We are pretty complete to 13th magnitude. In fact, we're probably complete to about 13.7 and then start falling off around 14th. Okay, but we're cutting the catalog. I haven't put it. All the data will be available, but we're going to analyze the catalog at a brighter magnitude to be a little conservative. We've tested the magnitudes by comparing the photometry from 2Mass against published photometry, where people have used individual detectors or individual arrays to measure individual galaxies, usually with much longer integration times than we have. And this is just one set from the Cancer cluster. Most of the existing infrared photometry of galaxies comes from clusters of galaxies, and as you can see, this is, I think this is us versus them, and then this is the differential as a function of magnitude. The scatter is well within the range that we would like to get. The goal of the survey was 10% photometry at 13.5, and we are meeting that without any trouble. Right? Well, with a little bit of trouble. It took a hell of a lot of software to get it to work. Right? But intrinsically, the data is very good. Same thing. This is all of the data that we've got as comparison checks for photometry, northern hemisphere versus southern hemisphere. I should tell you we have two matched telescopes, one in the north, one in the south, and one of the issues is, of course, to try to stitch the sky together to be really uniform. Remember, I was complaining about the uniformity of the optical surveys. In fact, even of the IRAS surveys, there are difficulties with the uniformity. So one of the things that we are doing as part of the verification work for this is checking the photometry from the different telescopes against each other, right? And it turns out that there's a 1% differential, and we'll fix this because they're different standard stars, 1% differential, 1% difference in the photometry from the northern telescope and the southern telescope. That's a factor of 4 better than we thought we would be able to do. We thought we'd be able to do about 0.04 magnitudes. We're really doing about 0.01, at least, hemisphere calibrations. And we think we can take that out by Martinizing the standard stars after Martin Weinberg, who invented the technique. If you look at the number of counts of galaxies as a function of galactic latitude, okay, in the faintest bins, where, of course, you'd expect the biggest trouble, things do run into some difficulties at low galactic latitude. But for bright galaxies at K, the number counts are pretty uniform. And you only get into trouble at below 10 degrees galactic latitude. You can also see that by looking at the fractional, essentially the derivative of that. Okay. Excuse me? We'd need to do 2 things. In the galactic plane, we would need longer integrations, but more importantly, what we'd really need, what's happening here is that the star-galaxy separation algorithm is failing because the stellar density is so high. And what we found is that once the stellar density is above about 10 to the 4 per square degree, okay, which happens at a galactic latitude of about 5 degrees, 5 and a half degrees or so, the star-galaxy separation algorithm picks out too many double, quadruple, quintuple stars as galaxies. We can no longer separate them. And that's in part due to the fact that we've got 1.4 arcsecond angular resolution. So the real key thing, if you wanted to do better, would be to scan the plane with bigger detectors and greater angular resolution. If we had a factor of 3 in angular resolution, we could probably quite easily fill in that gap down a degree or so of the plane. We may do that, but we're getting tired. Well, let's put it this way. To the galactic center, it's about 30 magnitudes AV, and AK is 0.1 of AV. So it's about 3 magnitudes to the galactic center. So we would want to up the integration time by, roughly speaking, a factor of 10 and increase the pixelization as well. Remember this, too, for the experimentalists in the room, this is being done with 256 squared detectors, which are now tiny compared to the state of the art. But we've got them and they work, and that's very important. And just to show you again the magnitude errors, the repeatability. What we have are multiple scans in Hercules. We essentially scan the cluster many, many, many times so that we could look at the dispersion of our own measurements as a function of magnitude, K, H, and J. This plot's a little difficult to see if you're too far away, but this is the 10% line over here, the red dotted line as it goes across. I can never convince the IPAC guys to make slides black and white. But anyway, where the lines cross are about, in fact, in the case of J, better by about half a magnitude than the spec. Right? At H, we're meeting the spec by about a tenth of a magnitude. And at K, we're pretty much on the spec. We wanted to do 10% at 13.5, and that's what's happening. The current situation of the survey. This is what's been scanned, not necessarily what's been reduced. Okay, the green stuff has been scanned and checked, so we know that it's photometric. The yellow stuff has been scanned, and essentially we're not absolutely sure the scans meet our quality requirements. So in other words, if we scan a chunk of sky and it's not photometric, or the seeing was bad so that we can't do the galaxy star separation or whatever, we'll go back and rescan it. This is what remains to be done. This is essentially an equatorial plot, the southern hemisphere being done from Tololo, the northern hemisphere being done from Mount Hopkins. We started at plus 12 degrees and worked north because the north is less photometric than the south. So we've got the equator left to do. It's actually not too bad. And as I said, this is January 26th, 2000. We've been working for about probably 3.5 years in the north, 2.5 years in the south. We think another year will finish this off and, in fact, allow us to rescan anything that's bad. The science part of the game is to turn the catalog into something with information about large-scale structure, and also, for the purpose of the workshop that's going on here, something about information on the properties of galaxies. Right? So the game that comes on after this is what's called the two-mass redshift survey, 2MRS. Right? The first part of the project is to work to K of 12.2. That's a limit where we think we're pretty complete. We won't have problems with star-galaxy separation even at relatively low galactic latitude, and we can get enough telescope time to actually make the spectroscopic measurements. That's a key part of the game. There are about 125,000 galaxies. We expect to have about 125,000 galaxies to that magnitude limit, where the magnitudes are isopodal magnitudes at K to 20 magnitudes per square arc second. 90% of the sky, 90% plus completeness is the goal of the redshift survey. Of course, we'll try to do better than that. We already have about 60,000 of the redshifts that are necessary for this from existing surveys. In other words, there's no reason I can't use a redshift we measured for the CFA survey, or a redshift if it comes from Sloan, or a redshift if it comes from the 2DF surveys or any of the IRAS surveys to essentially fill in the catalogs here. In the north, observations are being made at Mount Hopkins using the same little old 60-inch telescope that we've used before. Arecibo, we hope to get on the GBT. We have a lot of Arecibo time. We hope to get on the GBT when it's up and running. And we're also working at Nanke, the 21-centimeter program there with Wim Van Driel, and a little bit, some small number of observations from MDM and from ARC. Right? In the south, 2MASS is the primary source designator for what's called a 6DF survey. That is essentially a redshift survey using a 48-inch Schmidt telescope with a 150-fiber plug plate and a 6-degree field of view. That turns out to be a pretty good match to the magnitude limit that we're trying to get to. That's actually going to start operations, if we can find a detector for the spectrograph, probably next winter, fingers crossed. Okay, we're getting some data from Parkes, from SAAO, the South African Astronomical Observatory, Tony Farrell. And I have long-term status for the low galactic latitude part that we can't do with 6DF at Cerro Tololo to get observations on the 60-inch there. Most of these redshifts are being done one at a time. The reason for that is simply that even with 125,000 galaxies, the density on the sky is still such that one at a time is more efficient than trying to do, you know, hundreds at a time, although that will come for the deeper surveys. And in fact, some small regions of the sky are being done with multi-fiber instruments down to the limit of the two-mass survey, about 14th magnitude at K. Once we finish, by the way, that survey will have an effective depth that says something on the order of 0.1 in Z, as opposed to about 0.04 for the CFA survey. Once we finish, we want to do 1 in 10 to the complete limit, K of 13.5. That will probably take me through retirement, or at least I'll be tired of flying to Chile and Australia and Tucson. Okay. And just for comparison, this is the kind of thing, I need about another 5 minutes to finish up, if that's okay. Just for comparison, this is what the surveys will do relative to some of the ones that are around. The ORS, 60% of the sky, a depth of about Z of 0.02, selection limit B of 14, the density is okay, 5,500 galaxies. CFA plus SSRS, the Southern Sky Redshift Survey, similar kinds of things. Depth is a little bit bigger, 0.04, 30,000 galaxies. So on and so forth. The best of the all-sky surveys, PSCZ, 85% of the sky, depth of about 0.05, density poor, 15,000 galaxies. Some very high density, but not all-sky surveys, SDSS, about 15% of the sky, depth of about 0.25 in Z. So this survey is going to produce superb information on galaxy statistics, but it's not going to do the whole sky map. Right? Very good density, million galaxies. 2DF, 8% of the sky, same depth in redshift, 250,000 galaxies. The two-mass redshift survey with the 6DF survey in the south, 85% of the sky, a redshift that, an effective depth that's about 0.06. We'll be able to map structure to about 0.1. Very good density, 125,000. And if we actually get to do the extension, bear sampling, 250,000 galaxies, and an effective depth of about 0.12. So we'll have a real map of the local universe, at least at the 10% of the horizon radius, I'm hoping, in about 5 years. Work in progress. Now, let me just show you a small amount of the results that we can get from the survey so far. Most of them are on the properties of galaxies, and I'm sure the physicists in the room will be bored, but the astronomers might actually find it interesting. One of the things that we found, and we have overwhelming statistics, as you can see, the numbers here, 60,000 in this plot scale up there on the left. Colors of galaxies. The colors of galaxies in the infrared are incredibly uniform. Right? Very small dispersion. Right? The dispersion here is about a tenth of a magnitude in J minus H. In fact, in J minus K, the biggest band, 1.2 microns to 2.2 microns, you see a dispersion which is not much bigger. Here's just the plot in the two-color diagram. And in fact, this is not particularly representative because the whole core of this image is burned out. Okay, sigma J minus H is 0.08. Sigma H minus K is 0.09. Right? These are all the galaxies with velocities less than 24,000 and brighter than K of 12.5. Nearby galaxies, there's a low redshift. You can actually see the mean color of the sample shift with redshift quite nicely. So much so, in fact, that we can get crude distance estimates, good enough for things like luminosity functions, without ever measuring a redshift. Okay. Again, the distribution. This is this cut that you see over here is actually one of the color criteria we use to illuminate stars. But as you can see, it doesn't really change the distribution very much. H minus K versus J minus H. Very, very, very small scatter. Okay. And to show you the other plot, this I'll just flash up. Color versus redshift for everything in the sample. And this is the J minus K color versus redshift plot. The dispersion around this is about 0.08 of a magnitude. In fact, a little bit smaller than that. So you can measure redshift even after a redshift of 0.2, well, even inside a redshift of 0.2, relatively accurately just by measuring the J minus K color of a galaxy. You can look at colors as a function of morphological type. Again, the plot is burned out. SuperMongo has a tendency to put points on top of one another. But the green points are the irregular galaxies, Magellanic irregulars. The red points are the early type galaxies, even as zeros. And the blue points are spirals. You'll, in fact, notice something rather curious. Spiral galaxies can be redder in J minus K than elliptical galaxies. Anybody guess the reason for that? Astronomy 201. Why can some spiral galaxies be redder than elliptical galaxies in J minus K? All right, I'll leave that as an exercise for the workshop. And again, mean color, B minus K as a function of morphological type for the sample here. Give that man a gold star, it's dust. There are some really, especially at the high luminosity end, spiral galaxies are very dusty. Even in the infrared, the colors are reddened. And again, huge uniformity in the colors. This is one of the most amazing things about this. The function of morphological type, the J minus K color, actually, on the average, doesn't change very much. So in many ways, the neat thing that I thought this would be true, but I wasn't sure, well, one of the neat things about this survey is that the color selection by going to the near-infrared to pick out galaxies really does not get biased significantly by variations in morphological type. And I could show you a bit more of that, not worth it. This is where we stand on the data. Essentially, these are all the galaxies brighter than 12.2 in the survey, in the catalog right now. We have some problems at low galactic latitudes. You can see the galactic center picking up there. These are extended sources. Anything that's red, we haven't got a redshift for. Anything that's some other color, we do have a redshift, and the colors are coded by redshift. And in fact, that's where we stand in terms of redshift. There are about 24,000 redshifts in the 12.2 magnitude sample now. And as I said, the whole sky isn't surveyed, and we haven't completed the redshifts in the regions that have been surveyed. Just to give you one or two last glimpses of why it's important. This is the CFA2 survey, complete. No more redshifts coming to this one. Magnitude 15.5. We have essentially everything over the whole northern hemisphere in the catalog. Look at what the galactic plane does on both sides here. Pisces, Perseus. This is two mass now. Almost, well, how would I put it? Partially complete. We're about 25% complete in the sense that we still are missing 25%, about half of the area, in this wedge, just 10 degrees to 50 degrees of declination. And we only have about half of the redshifts for the galaxies that we have identified in that region. Same region of the sky. You can see we quite nicely can fill in the low galactic latitude stuff. Other things that can be done with the existing samples, you can look at the luminosity function for galaxies. And again, the astronomers will be interested. Right? The number density of galaxies is a function of type. And most importantly, the other piece of the puzzle, one of the things that I was hoping for, going back to the days of Mark Aronson and Jeremy Mould and myself working on distances, the infrared Tully-Fisher relation, it's a technique for measuring. It's one of the techniques that's used to fill in that Mark III catalog. It's a technique for measuring independent distances to galaxies by using velocity widths to estimate absolute luminosity in the infrared. Infrared, again, is pretty important. We have galaxies at low galactic latitude. This is a edge-on spiral galaxy at a galactic latitude of 2 degrees. This is the spectrum from Arecibo in 21 centimeters. Very nice velocity width. If we can get rid of the stellar contamination, we'll have a pretty good magnitude. We can estimate a distance, a Hubble constant independent distance to this galaxy, even at a galactic latitude of 2 degrees for the velocity field studies. We've been testing how well we can do this in clusters where data does exist for velocity widths. And in fact, the K-band Tully-Fisher relations that we find are actually very, very good. Small scatter, luminosity versus log of velocity width. Over here, log W corrected. So essentially, any galaxy, any spiral galaxy that's edge-on enough, that has a 21-centimeter profile too, will be able to add to the velocity field determination. And right now, we have about 10,000 of these, mostly from Brent Tully and from Rachel Webster at Parkes. And I have a student madly working on doing this for his thesis, to try to do a new determination of the velocity field, and that we can match up with the density field. So if I come back in about 5 years, maybe even sooner, not only will we be able to do some of that, but maybe I'll be able to tell you a little bit more about what's come out of the match between the density field and the velocity field, what the bias factor is, what omega matter is, at least from the flow field studies, where the dark matter is, if it's not associated with galaxies, and how it's associated with galaxies if it is. And that's it. Let's go have some ice cream. Oh, we are. One of the things that we do need to, it causes us to have to rescan regions of the sky, the variable OH emission at the H band. And what's happened is that we've ended up relaxing our constraints in the H band a little bit, because in fact it doesn't affect us much at K band. And hardly at all at the J band, right? But H band, let's put it this way. We can see variations of factors of 20 in the H band sky background, right? On very short time scales, which translate into variations at the level of about 10 or 20% at K and about 5 to 10% at J at the same time. Do we see a fractal? Loaded question. The answer is that over some range of scale, the distribution does indeed look like a fractal, or what Pietranero would call a multifractal fractal. Okay. Would I, as an observer, characterize the clustering properties of galaxies as a single fractal? Certainly not. As a multifractal, I tell my students in the experimental course that there are 10 words I want them to know, and to be able, and this is especially true for Harvard students, believe me, it's tough, right? Those 10 words are know and be able to use. I don't know. I was wrong. It can be fixed. Is it a multifractal over a very large range of scales? I don't know. I would bet against it, but I wouldn't bet large sums of money. $1.14, but this does not include the reprocessing for low surface brightness galaxies. That's another talk, right? If you, I mean, that really is another talk, right? If you really take a look at the surface brightness distributions of galaxies, it's the low surface brightness galaxies that are causing the upturn at the faint end. Excuse me? Haven't done it yet. Right. We have, I should tell you, we do have a low surface brightness processor. Right? It takes about 8 times as much computer time. Right now we're at the level of being able to process a night's worth of data in a night. And we have 2 Sun, whatever it is, Sun 40Xs or whatever, doing the data analysis. Right? When we turn on the low surface brightness processor, that drops to 1 night and 8 nights. And we will do it for the final processing, but we haven't done it now. We know we can pick up low surface brightness galaxies. I've got plots up in my office that I can show you. Some really raspy things that we picked up in Virgo. Right. Right. That's probably true. The really low surface brightness ones you can't get. But things like the dwarfs in the Virgo cluster that Bingley, Sandage, and Tamon played with her in Fornax, we can find reasonable fraction of those. If we'd done it in space, we could have done it easily. Well, thought at the moment, there is a fairly major cluster complex down there called ABOL 3627 and a couple of its friends. And off to one side is another major cluster complex at a redshift of about 13,000 called the Shapley concentration. Shapley, in fact, found it back in the 1930s. In neither case is the direction quite right, although ABOL 3627 is much closer than Shapley. Right? In the case of ABOL 3627, the studies that have been primarily done in the optical, and they're so incomplete that it's very difficult to estimate the mass of the cluster. That's one of the places. Yeah. Well, 3627 is one of the places where we've actually started drilling using Las Campanas and the 100-inch and the fiber, and you have to put multiple fiber optic plates to get redshifts down to the catalog limit. And what would be the right word? There's a postdoc working on the data who should be working on a lot of other things first, like writing his thesis up. So I'm under orders from Roger Blanford and Judy Cohen not to let him work on the 2-mass data until he writes his thesis up. You can guess who that is. Thank you.